Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you here listening. And we're also glad to have you here in the studio with us, David Desser. He's professor of cinema studies at U of I. Every once in a while, he stops by here. We talk about movies, and we're glad to have him here. We do several things on these programs. Sometimes he talks about movies that he's seen recently. We tell people who are listening, you can do the same. You can be the reviewer. You can call in and say, I've seen this particular movie, and either I think it was very good and I'd recommend it, or I'd say, save your money, don't bother with that. Other sorts of questions, too, about movies, the history of film and how movies are made, we'd be happy to take any of those. And all you have to do is call in. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Something that I thought I would ask you about, I was thinking about the fact that now here in town we're going to have, I don't think it started yet, a new film series at the Virginia Theater where they're going to show what we might call some classic popular popular classic movies.
Yeah, I think that starts next month.
In November. And I think that Citizen Kane, as a matter of fact, is the first
I think so.
Movie. And this will give some people the opportunity to see some movies that that probably they have only seen on television. Because
that's right.
You just don't
that's
see
right.
stuff like this
right.
on the big screen. So you can really get the full, you can know what it was like for the folks who saw it the first time in theater. What I was sort of wondering about was directors today, when they know the size of the screens pretty much that their movies are going to be shown on. And I think about when I was a kid, I went to theater in my town, and it was a good-sized screen, and I will bet it's got to be at least four times bigger than the screens now that I see at the multiplex, at least. And what I was wondering about is, does that mean that directors today think differently about how you make a movie than the directors of our childhood or of the classic era? And the difference being that one guy knew he had this huge screen and the other guy knows, well, no, I've only got this much screen.
Well, that's a very good question. I would like to turn back, before I answer that or discuss that, to something you said there, and that is the difference of seeing a movie on the screen and on TV, regardless of how a director may have intended to compose it. Back in the classic era, I mean, all the way through the early 1960s, very few filmmakers thought other than the movie screen for their film. And so that, you know, they just made the movie with the knowledge that it would be seen on a reasonably big screen, if not a huge screen, and in a movie theater with an audience. And there's just such an enormous difference between seeing Citizen Kane on a screen, on a big screen, than on TV. So although many, you know, anyone who's a serious movie fan has seen every movie that they're going to show at the Virginia, you're absolutely right to say that to see it on the big screen is just a rare opportunity and really should be taken advantage of. Now, happily, when in the years that I was living in Los Angeles, there was a movie theater, now defunct, in downtown L.A. that showed nothing but old Hollywood movies in 35mm and often had new prints. And this was, a rare opportunity. So even if one saw films in classroom in 16mm on a sort of medium-sized screen, the difference of seeing it in 35mm in a real theater was just a pleasure. So I was very lucky when living and going to school in L.A. to see these movies on a big screen. And you really get a greater appreciation not only for the director but for the actor and the screenwriter and just the whole mood and tone of these movies. It's just so different on a big screen that there's no comparison. Now, to answer your question, one thing we have to keep in mind is that before 1955 or so, movies were made in a ratio of 4x width to height, which is the standard ratio of television, so that you're not losing so much of the visual image when you go to non-letterboxed or just regular TV. Now, of course, you are compacting it, and you're not giving people as much opportunity to see what's there. But at least the way the actors stand and relate to each other and to the set is almost the same on TV from the classic era. But since 1955, all American movies have been made in one form of widescreen or another. And we distinguish between widescreen, which is just cropping the image so that it's 1.85 times as wide as it is high, and then the CinemaScope screen, which is that super wide image used, which requires special lenses. And that's 2.35 to 1. So that when you see that image at 4-3 or 1-3-3-1, you are losing a good 50% of what's there. And no director today, I think, would dare make a movie in widescreen without recognizing that it will not be letterboxed and that it will be seen on a smaller screen. And it's only the rare movie that, you know, either must be letterboxed or a director simply doesn't care. But the fact of the matter is that more people will see a movie on video, letterboxed or not, than they will on the big screen. And therefore, they are very careful not to put too much visual information on the frame, not to mention the kind of framing that they'll use, because you simply don't have the time, the energy, or even the ability to see what's there, even if you have a 35, 36-inch TV. Now, HD TV will make a big difference, because it's already formatted for widescreen, and it provides much more visual information. So, you know, but to answer your question, there is a consciousness on the part of filmmakers of what their film will look like and sound like on the small screen. Which is why, you know, to a certain extent, I say, you know, in many instances, a movie, if you don't really feel like going to a theater and spending all that money, relatively speaking, you know, waiting for the video, especially DVD, which is infinitely superior to tape, you know, in some instances doesn't make that much of a difference, which may be a kind of heresy for a film professor to say. But I'm finding that this consciousness of video and the recognition that DVD provides a lot more sound quality, for instance, than tape, you know, it's a compromise, but, you know, I'm willing to live with it for some mediocre movies. Mm. So especially when, as you say, that the screen is not nearly as big today. And so, sure. You know, you almost feel like by the time you're getting yourself an HD TV, theaters are really going to be have to compete. Now, you notice one thing that they have done over the last 10 years or so is mall screens are much bigger than they used to be. I mean, there were some multiplexes, most of them now defunct, that used to be called, you know, Cracker Barrel, Cracker Boxes. And they really were too small and too dark, and the sound bled through the walls. Now they're going for the bigger screen. This is enabled by the stadium seating, which kind of lets you look down so you can actually make the screen wider. And, of course, most of the advances of visual imagery outside of digital stuff, most of the advances for film has been in sound. That's where the last 10 years theaters, everything is Dolby or SDDS and this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And all of this, of course, is trying to compete with the home image, which is why DVD it really is a competitor, because it provides the 5-1 kind of sound ratio that you get. So, but these are some of the technologies. But at least mall screens are better than they used to be, but they're not, almost none of them is as big as the average neighborhood screen used to be. I remember I lived in a neighborhood in Brooklyn which had a local theater called the Rugby. Not exactly the Paramount or the Fox. And in the mall days, the Rugby was so big that they could cut it up and make two theaters out of it, because it was just a big screen, and you just took it for granted. I mean, it was at least as big, perhaps, as the Virginia.
Yeah.
And this is just, you know, a movie theater in Flatbush.
Well, I lived in a relatively small town, one of the northwest Chicago suburbs, and went to a theater called the Pickwick. And in fact, for a while, when there still was Siskel and Ebert. Mm-hmm. One of the versions of the show in the beginning where you see them walking into the theater, where they sort of meet on the front and then walk in, that was the Pickwick Theater, which is a very nice Art Deco kind of building. So, and that was place that I went to movies when I was a kid. And this was a relatively small town, but that was a big screen. It's probably not as big as the screen at the Virginia, but it was pretty big.
And also, you speaking of Citizen Kane and movie theaters and all that, I'll remind people that Citizen Kane, which was an RKO picture, Citizen Kane premiered in New York City at the Radio City Music Hall. So, you know, you talk about a big screen in a big theater. I mean, that's where Citizen Kane, which did pretty well at the box office and was critically acclaimed, by the way. If you go back and look at the original reviews of Citizen Kane, I remember being struck by one guy writing, "Citizen Kane is quite possibly the best film ever made."
Even
I said, this
then?
Guy, yeah. Well, he was, you know, it wasn't the universal idea, but it did get nominated for Academy Awards, etc. But it just struck me that talking about big screens and neighborhood theaters, that Citizen Kane opened at the Radio City Music Hall.
Yeah. Well, I know we've talked about Citizen Kane before, and I don't know if people will say, yeah, I've heard all about it. I guess the one thing I would say about Citizen Kane is that whether you think it's the greatest movie ever made or not, it has remarkable, every frame has an amazing amount of detail and richness in it. And if you, something that I think you only can really appreciate if you see it on a big screen. It really gets lost on television.
Well, you know, I think you're right. It's famous for any number of reasons, but one of the things that it does do is it relies strongly on deep focus, which means every element of the image is in focus at the same time. Mm-hmm. And what deep focus does is it makes you sort of examine the image. Where shall I look? I have information in the foreground, in the middle ground, in the background. People are talking to each other. People are coming in and out. The camera angle is interesting. There's a lot of things to sort of search out for. Television, because it really has been so geared to dialogue, it has taught us, you know, not to pay that much attention. I mean, how many times have people sort of left the room keeping an ear to the screen without necessarily feeling they have to watch it? Not to mention flipping around channels during boring parts. So, you know, you're right. The TV screen, it makes it more difficult to see. Doesn't really encourage the kind of concentration that movie theaters by definition encourage, because it's dark. I mean, you might as well look at the screen because you can't see that much else. But Welles was very careful to pack his frame with sound and imagery that really made the audience pay attention. So, assuming it's a good print, which I imagine it would be, because Turner Classics did restore it some years ago, it will provide an experience that even a good Laserdisc or DVD won't quite provide. Mm.
Just for a second, going back to that question I asked about, do directors do things differently because they know that they have a smaller screen size to work with? So it sounds like what you're saying is that not only are they composing the shot so that what the important stuff is right in the middle, there actually is less, they put less visual information on the screen. There's actually less to look at. Not only is it centered, but there's not as much going on.
I would say that's typically the case. And where you really see this is when movies were made with an eye to the big screen without regard for its eventual showing on the small screen. And so the movies made in CinemaScope in the 1950s are absolutely unwatchable on television unless they're letterboxed, because people will be talking to nobody, or there'll be a hand peeking out from the left side of the frame, and it's just impossible. Ebert did a good job some years ago of demonstrating the importance of letterboxing by showing the chariot race from Ben-Hur, letterboxed and then not letterboxed. And it's almost like, you know, he's running around by himself and occasionally glancing over, and you're saying, what is he looking at? And then when you see it letterboxed, of course, you see that there's about eight other chariots in there, and he's got a lot of trouble. So, it is the case that they're visually less sophisticated and will compose with an eye toward what it will eventually look like. And they do that very simply by putting a plate in the camera that shows them their widescreen image, but also at the same time shows them the image that it will look like when it goes to 4:3. So it's like a drawing, you know, you have a little drawing inside the camera so that the cameraman can actually have an eye. Now, some directors won't, of course, care. And other directors, such as Woody Allen back in the 80s, insisted that, for instance, Manhattan be only released letterboxed and not available in any other format. And with DVD, because the image is so much clearer, letterboxing is quite common. But even so, filmmakers today recognize that DVD is still not as popular as tape, and movies will still be shown on HBO and et cetera, which rarely, though not never, rarely letterboxes.
Our guest this morning is David Desser. He's professor of cinema studies at University of Illinois and occasionally is here on the show with us, and we talk about movies, and your questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Freeport, line 4. Hello?
Yeah, Professor Desser.
Yes.
Yeah, about Citizen Kane, I feel it was sort of a early version of The Godfather. Orson Welles' acting style. It was celebrated business form of business fascism. Then, you know, as Welles portrayed this guy that rose to the top of the business industrial world, you know, and. I think it celebrated fascism, really. at that time, and much like The Godfather in later years, you know. And I suppose people have never seen it in this country. There was a film they made of the Cuban Revolution called Historia de la Revolución, and I suppose it's never been allowed to be shown in this country. I saw it when I was in Cuba. Hmm. It was very impressive, you know. And it was a very authentic and realistic, you know, almost chronicle the day-to-day development of the revolution down there.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting what you say about Citizen Kane because, you know, for the most part, people imagine that the story, loosely or not loosely based on William Randolph Hearst, was a criticism of Hearst, which is why the Hearst papers tried to savage the film. And Welles himself came out of a kind of, what shall we say, solid left-wing credentials from his work in the work projects, the WPA Theater. And so, you know, whether the celebration of fascism would certainly be something that Welles and many of his defenders would vehemently deny. Whereas what you say about The Godfather, I think, is quite interesting. And I thought you were going to compare it to The Godfather also in that he really bucked the trend in terms of spending so much time and effort in creating a realistic as well as kind of dense visual layering. I mean, one of the things that's impressive about The Godfather and The Godfather Part Two is how rich that movie is visually and historically. As I say, I think most people would not necessarily find Citizen Kane to be a celebration of a kind of fascism.
Yeah, I think
instead an attack on it, especially during the soon to be war years.
The thing that strikes me about it is that the movie, as people will recall, the movie begins with the death of the character Charles Foster Kane, and then this wonderful newsreel that was put together aiming at answering this question was, who is this guy? Then they finish, the guys are sitting around watching the newsreel, and somebody says, well, this really doesn't tell us who this guy is, and that's when they go on this quest to find out what his last words meant, Rosebud. And so what strikes me is that it, in the end, it's the story of a man who never was in search of love all of his life. Was essentially a lonely person, mm-hmm. who never had a normal childhood, never had, and was always looking for that. And that strikes me that's, you know, maybe at the time, you know, Freud was well known and his ideas are well known, but it would be unusual to take that kind of psychoanalytic approach that we'd feel sort of very comfortable with that idea today of psychobiography. But at the time, it seems like that would have been sort of an unusual approach today.
Absolutely. And I would also suggest that the film strikes us today still as very modern, because although you could say, we won't give away the ending, but you could say that there's something unknowable about Charles Foster Kane, that do you really know anyone, and does learning facts explain things? And so there's a kind of very modern idea of things are not clear. Things are ambiguous. And so in that respect, I would say the film retains a lot of its power. The other thing that I would say about the first caller is that good acting, or at least generally decent acting, you will feel for the person. And it would be a very strange film and not a very good film if you hated Kane. And therefore, you might be tended to think the film sides with him and his actions and his overbearingness or his neo-fascism, and that the danger of a film is that you make a hero out of your protagonist just on the basis of people want someone to identify with. That's why films, sometimes can be very, very tricky when you make a film about a bad guy. I mean, this happened, you know, with Schindler's List. The most compelling actor in Schindler's List was Ralph Fiennes. And so did the film humanize this guy? Was that a good idea? Is it a bad idea? I mean, obviously the Nazis were human, but you know, did you make him a little too sympathetic, for instance? So that's what I would say. But I think Kane really holds up because it's so rich and so layered. Not that I think it's the greatest movie ever made, but it certainly is a great film. I mean, you would be hard pressed to say that it's not one of the greatest movies ever made, and it really is. And it's actually a lot of it, I think, is very funny. I think people forget forget how funny it is in parts. And I actually think Welles is a terrific actor. And remember that he's 24 years old when he made the film. It's very difficult, I think, for a 24-year-old to show aging. And that's really a tribute to, you know, youngsters don't really know what it's like to get older. They will find out.
Okay, let's go on. Let's have a couple of other folks here. Next in the line is a caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes. I have two questions that are related. One is I read recently in the newspaper that last year 450 movies were made. Now, I was curious to know how many of these are pictures that are released in theaters and how many of these junky made-for-television movies. But in addition to that, I just had something for you to think about or comment on, and that is the question of, it seems to me, as somebody who remembers movies from the studio days, that there definitely are too many movies, and it's hard to make a choice of which ones to go to see. I mean, if in a town like this you have 20 different movies playing at the same time, well, you know, of course, that you're not going to, if there's some movie about a girl detective in Reno, Nevada, or something like that, we're going to see that. But then, you get others which critics acclaim and so on and so forth. And so I find myself in a very peculiar situation that an evening I might think, well, tonight would be a good night to go to the movies, and I look down the list of movies, and there's so many of them that could be possibilities, and then I wind up not going to any because it's not like in the old days when you knew, well, here was an outstanding film, or here was something that had Clark Gable in it, or it had your favorite movie actress, Myrna Loy, or whatever, you know. So I guess I'm not the kind of person who makes the Hollywood money men very happy, because it just seems that the plethora of films that there are is just so overwhelming that I just don't want to take the bother of picking and choosing from these various things.
Okay, well, those are very good questions. When you say 450 movies were made, there are more movies being released in theaters now than there were in the recent past. But of those 450 movies, I would say you're going to see maybe 300 at the most in theaters. Many of those movies will be released overseas, and many of those movies are what's now called direct-to-video. You, after all, have to feed the maw of Cinemax and Cinemax 2. And so these movies, so you won't see 450 movies in theaters. But paradoxically, in the studio era of the 30s and 40s, Hollywood made that many movies or more than are made today. So in fact, there were more movies to choose from then than there are now, typically. But I think that the point you mentioned about it was easier for people to choose then because they sort of knew what they were getting or were happy to see the latest Clark Gable or the latest Spencer Tracy or the latest Katharine Hepburn or Myrna Loy. So there was a fan base, but in fact, there were more movies in the studio era than there are today. But I also think that one of the big differences is that movies come out in bunches today, whereas in the studio era, they weren't so geared around the seasons. Oh, now it's summer, so we're going to come out with 75 movies in 3 months or 2 months, or it's Christmas, and every good movie that you want to see comes out between Thanksgiving and Christmas Day. They were spread out over a period, you know, once a week you could see a new movie. Also, I think people in those days went to the movies more regularly. And so it didn't seem like so many movies, where if you went to the movies once a week, you could pretty much keep up with your neighborhood theater and your favorite stars. Whereas now, if you go to the movies every so often, you look at these movies, half of them you never heard of. A third of them are not going to be the kind of movies that grown-ups want to see. And then you sort of say, well, I don't really know what to see. I'll just wait for video. So I think there's a psychology involved in movie going. So, but you know, in a way, no one's going to see, except for reviewers, I guess, no one's going to see 250 or 300 films a year. But if you see 50 or 60, I think you can actually manage to see the good ones. But somehow people don't do that anymore. And so that's really what I think is going on.
Right. I think that explains the situation pretty well, as far as I'm concerned. But it does leave me lurch, and I don't know whether you've ever spoken to anybody else that's had this problem because of the excess number that seem to be there that are nondescript. You take a fatalistic attitude and say, oh, well, I'll do something else instead of go to the movie.
No, I've come to the point now there'll be five or six movies I haven't seen, but somehow I don't really feel like seeing any of them. It just happens that way. But I think one of the problems is they release them in bunches, and they really, it's not that good of an idea. Mm-hmm. And then there'll be, of course, you know, weeks will go by where there'll be one movie that comes out and it's not very good. So it's not just that they release them in bunches, but it's that, like, on November 5th there'll be four good new movies to see. And then, of course, Christmas Day or, you know, et cetera. It's just a real problem. And you know what also happens is I think, you know, with the syndrome of, you know, the first week's box office, if you don't see it in the first week, it's almost like, oh, well, that's it. It's an old movie now. I don't want to see an old movie. So releasing new movies in bunches really works against the one or two movies that don't open big. Because then they seem that they're not that good or they're not that interesting and people don't go to see them. So there's all kinds of sort of pressures and psychologies going on today that are very different. But with the seasons, I think movie studios really make a mistake in bunching these movies together. Mm.
And I think that it's also true that there now is, from the studio's point of view and from the exhibitor's point of view, there is this big pressure for movies to make a lot of money right in the first couple of days.
Oh, absolutely.
And if they don't,
yeah,
then the theater owners are standing around saying, oh, let's get this dog out of here and put something new. And movies don't have a chance to build audience anymore, because if you don't make a $40 million out of the gate, then you're a failure. And after a few days of that, or maybe a week of that, then somebody's going to say, well, this movie's no good. We need to get someone that's going to get some money in here. And,
oh, no, you're
and
right.
It's gone.
Yeah, and it's, I call it the winning and losing syndrome. And that is, if you're not, it's the weekend grosses, right? Friday the movie opens, and on Tuesday all of the newspapers are reporting the weekend grosses, right? And that's a really new phenomenon. It didn't used to be the case that people cared how much money a movie made. They cared about, is it any good? So this, what I call the business of movie business, is now a kind of public discourse, whereas it never used to be. You don't have any idea how much money Citizen Kane cost, unless you're a scholar, or how much money Citizen Kane grossed. And it doesn't really matter. It didn't matter that much, although, I mean, to a certain extent it did. But nobody really paid attention to that sort of thing. Now everybody pays attention to everything. So that if you're one of four movies that opens over the weekend, and you don't open as number one, you have lost. Mm-hmm. It's like, and you know, all over the industry newspapers, you know, number one box office gross, and they splay across two pages in Variety, you know, 17.9 million in its first weekend. Whereas, you know, you opened up and you only did 13 million. Oh well, that's terrible. So there's the sense of winning and losing. So it isn't even that theater owners want to get rid of it. It's that theater owners perceive that the studios, and they perceive correctly, that the studios won't continue to back, to advertise, to push a movie that, in fact, they may be stuck with for 6 weeks. But if you continue to advertise, or if you allowed word of mouth to build in a general way, the second or third week you might find a movie actually doing as well as it did or even better over its opening weekend. But nowadays, with the pressure to be number one as you open, it's, you know, it's this kind of contest that just leaves some movies behind. And it's really very obnoxious.
We're a bit past the midpoint here. Our guest is Dave Deser. He's professor of cinema studies at U of I. And every once in a while is here and we talk about movies, and your questions, comments are welcome. Maybe you'd like to tell us about something you've seen recently, or you have other thoughts about the movie business to share with us. That's great. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's another caller. This is Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I heard you mention the 3-4-4 format. For film, the picture size?
Yeah, the standard TV ratio is 4:3.
Okay, now,
right.
Is Isn't that what movies was in the 40s?
Yes, that's right. So when you see them on TV, you're not losing that much.
So if you're watching the older movies,
yes,
that's what you're seeing.
Pretty much, right.
There. Are movies today, any movies filmed in the 3-4 format or 4-3?
No.
Nothing filmed like that?
It's very, very rare that some art film might be, occasional European or Asian film might be 4-3. But no, essentially every movie is either 1.85 or CinemaScope. That is right.
When I see a thing that says made for television...
Yes.
It wasn't filmed for television?
If it says made for television, it was made 4.3.
4.3. Okay, would have been filmed in 4.3 then.
Yes.
Those are the ones that say made for television.
Right. Now, occasionally what they might do is they may release such a movie overseas, mm-hmm. in which case it's a slightly different widescreen, but it's not such a big deal that they managed to change it. So, but basically a made-for-TV movie is shot in 4.3. That's correct.
Okay. Now, down at the Virginia, when they ran... Lawrence of Arabia, that used the whole screen because it was 70 millimeter.
Yes.
And the screen then was 55 by 28. 55 feet wide and 28 feet tall.
Okay.
Curved. Now, the screen that we'll be using down there now is 22 by 50.
Okay.
Which I can't figure out any format at all.
You might. No, the Lawrence of Arabia, made in 70 and then when released to regular theaters, is essentially in widescreen CinemaScope.
Now, this Tuesday we'll be using the 4.3 format because we'll be running the Phantom of the Opera with the Wurlitzer accompaniment.
Okay.
The silent movie.
Right.
On there. Now, what format was Citizen Kane filmed in?
4:3.
Okay, it's the older format.
Yes. Right. There's no widescreen changes until 1952.
52. Okay. Now, I had talked to a retired film distributor, and he was telling me that they basically didn't want people to see pictures on large screens because in a couple generations they wouldn't know what they were missing.
I don't follow.
Well, why they didn't want to have them on big screens. Because the multiplexes, none of the multiplexes in town would be anything like what the Virginia is.
Oh, right, right.
Well, they figured if they only showed them in the smaller screens, people are used to the television.
Oh, right, right.
The smaller
right.
screens are a little bigger.
Yes.
If they don't see them on the big screens, in a few years, they won't know what they're missing.
Right. No, I think that's true.
And then where does IMAX fit in? Suddenly this has come along.
Well, IMAX is a special widescreen process that also is extremely expensive.
Yeah.
Because it shoots at about 80 frames per second.
Wow.
But it's a specialized format.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, what do they charge? $8 to $10 to see an IMAX movie. They're really geared toward kind of spectacle oriented thing. I mean, nobody's claiming that IMAX is a good format for a kind of made for TV drama. But it fits in as exactly as this kind of what I call spectacle vision.
Kind of like Cinerama was.
Yes, exactly like Cinerama was.
We went to the New Neon in Ohio.
Right, in Dayton, right.
And to see how the West was won.
Yeah, and of course, if you go back and look at Cinerama, there's only about a half dozen movies made in Cinerama, and the only one that anyone remembers is How the West Was Won, which isn't really that good of a movie.
Wonders of the World.
Yes, and the first Cinerama movie had the good sense to call it This Is Cinerama.
Yeah.
So okay, This Is Cinerama. But I remember seeing How the West Was Won in Cinerama when it first came out in about what, 62, 63 or so.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think it's true that people have been trained to sort of visually not to be able to watch a kind of densely impacted film, not know how to watch a movie on a big screen. I came back from a film festival where a number of films were really long, and there was a lot of talk about this movie's just too long, even before you saw it, because they're not only trained not to know how to look at movies, but they can't sit there very long. So if it's not 100 minutes or less, it's a disaster.
But we had Dances with Wolves here.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was out in the lobby up front, and a lady come out and wanted to know where the restroom was. And I said, upstairs. She said, how much longer has the movie got to go? And I said, about 10 minutes. And she said, well, how long has it been running? I said, about 3 hours. And she looked up the stairs and said, I can wait. And she went back in. It was a very long movie, but the thing ran 18 weeks.
Yes, occasionally people will take it.
Well, when they... When when they brought the board of directors over to show them that nobody was coming to the Virginia, they brought them over when there were six people after the thing had run 17 weeks in there.
Yeah, not exactly fair.
No, because when it was opened up, people were coming here to Champaign from towns that the movie was running in.
And I would say that people who saw it on a bigger screen enjoyed it more than people who saw it in a typical multiplex screen in those days.
From Springfield, Peoria, and Bloomington.
Right.
It was running at the same time there, but they came to the Virginia to see it here because of the screen.
Oh, well, I would say a longer movie is actually a much better idea in a movie theater than on TV, with the exception that on TV you can stop it.
Yeah.
But otherwise, a movie feels longer screen.
Like Roger said during his film festival, this is the way you should see a film with 1,000 of your friends.
Yeah, it's an interesting experience. We so rarely go to see, in this town it's so rare that a movie is crowded.
Yeah.
It really is a different experience, and really a telltale sign is if you see a movie in a very big theater that's very crowded, mm-hmm. is the audience quiet? Is the audience paying attention?
Mm-hmm.
Or is there a lot of people sort of rustling around and digging around or whispering about what they're going to do later?
Uh-huh.
A real tribute to a movie is, can it hold its audience? But I also think, by the way, that people have gotten so used to private viewing or a whole different kind of world view that, I find it difficult to go to a movie theater.
Yeah.
It's just crazy. I mean, they'll bring... they just talk too much during the movie. That's all I have to say. People should be quiet and let me watch the movie.
I've really enjoyed the Ebert Film Fest here and looking forward to it next April again.
Yes, end of April.
Yeah, right. So looking forward to that again there. So, but this Tuesday night, the Phantom, we're going to run the same print that we had before because it's a borrowed print that I borrowed from Indianapolis.
Okay.
Yes,
live musical accompaniment to silent movies is a rare treat, and it really is wonderful.
I'm going to accompany it on the Whirlwind Tour.
Excellent.
And that's fun. I've been doing several silent movies now down there, just practicing with them, but it's fun.
It is.
Interesting thing. Thank you
very
much.
Thank you. And certainly if, for people who've never seen The Phantom of the Opera with the immortal Lon Chaney. It's pretty cool.
It is. No, I would say cool. that, you know, we our image of silent movies is really unfair because not only were they never silent, they also looked much better. So our image of people scurrying around in fast motion or choppy prints or overacting, it's not really true. And it was an experience and an art form that was immensely popular. By 1925, silent movies in America were being produced at the rate of 500 or 600 a year. And that's not because people were stupid in those days. It's because the silent cinema had achieved an artistic level that people just were impressed by incredibly. And remember, in big theaters in big cities, silent movies not only would have piano or organ accompaniment, but they'd actually have live orchestral accompaniment. Much like the Krannert showing of Dracula, will have its musical accompaniment. Live music to a film really brings a dimension that's really very exciting. And people should remember that movies were a kind of total experience in those days. And they really were, you know, when you get to see things like that, you can understand why movies were so popular and so important.
It should be interesting. This is tonight happening on the campus. And maybe folks heard the other day Celeste Quinn in the afternoon was talking to Philip Glass. He's composed a score to go with the version that is the best loved and perhaps the best known, the one that Bela Lugosi made.
Yes, yes.
And it's going to be performed by the Kronos Quartet
exactly.
live, and they're going to
be there,
to show
yeah.
the movie.
Yeah.
And sounds like it should be pretty cool.
Well, it should be pretty cool, especially considering Dracula's a sound movie, so the music will add yet another dimension to it will be good. The Dracula version is surprisingly good. But as a 1931 movie, it's very stagey because the sound recording required that. So I actually think the musical accompaniment might actually make the film that much more exciting, which is an already good film. It's not particularly scary, but it's really quite interesting.
Yeah.
We can't expect the Dracula from 31 to be Halloween or Dawn of the Dead.
All right. Let's go on. We'll talk with somebody else here. Southeastern Illinois, line number 4. Hello?
Yeah, I couldn't let the subject go by without calling into express my strong feelings against widescreen movies on television. Now, in the movie houses, maybe they're fine. But on television, they are the pits. It's the old Beta and VHS were the superior marketing, or cramming things down people's throats gives them the inferior version rather than the superior. I mean, very few compositions are good. Turner has been running most movies, really, in letterbox anymore. And so it gives you some idea of what it's like on television. Now, I can't make any opinion as to what it would be in a movie theater with a large screen. That might be worthwhile, but I don't know. I mean, it's just the composition. You don't have the same rules of composition. You don't really have rules of composition. Most of the compositions, to have a close-up, they violate the first thing you teach a kid when you give him his first brownie, don't cut off the tops of their heads. And in a close-up, they generally will cut off the tops of their heads and sometimes the bottom of their chins. And it's just Scorsese, in his documentary on movies, quoted Fritz Lang when the thing first came out as saying that it was a format good only for snakes and funerals.
There was a lot of resistance to widescreen when it first came out.
You know why it came out? It came out as a selling gimmick.
It came out as a selling point to compete with television.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think many people would say that the widescreen format used properly by an artist, I don't think that people would think that Lawrence of Arabia, or whatever you think of it as drama, that Lawrence of Arabia is pictorially quite stunning, and it's a wonderful use of widescreen. Look at Kubrick's 2001.
There are some but it's the percentage is about maybe 5% of movies benefit from it. Most of them, back in the early days of movies, somebody couldn't afford an electric bill, and they lit the set dimly, and when somebody complained about it being so, you know, not much light there, he said, "Didn't you ever hear of Rembrandt lighting?" what we have here in the wide format is Edward Hopper composition. If you're familiar with Edward Hopper's, the American painter's compositions, they are, people are overwhelmed by their surroundings. I mean, they're, if there are any people in the picture at all, they are just sort of isolated in the surroundings. The surroundings overwhelm them.
Well, you know, you have a point, a good point, because, you know, not every film will benefit from CinemaScope. If you have an intimate drama, then you should be allowed to do it. My point would be that if you're going to use widescreen, you might as well use it well. And you're never going to be able to convince me that the films of Akira Kurosawa, starting in 1957, where he used a CinemaScope, you can't tell me that his compositions and his human drama aren't absolutely phenomenal. And every one of his films is in widescreen, and every one of his films is great. So if you're going to have widescreen, you might as well use it well. Now, the fact that people don't use it well is certainly a good point. But I do believe that in many instances, especially for the kind of action-oriented spectacle films, people use it well. For an intimate drama, it's probably not the best thing to do.
Just down to the point here, we are coming down to just having a couple minutes left. Before we find ourselves completely out of time, one of the things that I sometimes do when you're here is say, well, okay, so you're going to go down to the video place. You're going to rent something this weekend or tonight. Are there any movies that you might like to recommend, particularly say to people, okay, you missed these things when they were in the theater, or didn't have time, whatever. But now you're wanting to go back and see some movies. Anything in particular you'd like to recommend?
I have two, quite different. One is Tumbleweeds, which did get an Academy Award nomination for Janet McTeer, which otherwise got lost in the shuffle of too many movies at the same time. So Tumbleweeds, a nice small drama about a mother and daughter, not to be confused with the Susan Sarandon movie that came out about the same time about a mother and daughter. And also Love and Basketball, a very nice, surprisingly good drama, which might seem kind of odd, about a young man and a young woman, each of whom are devoted to basketball, but who fall in love, hence the title Love and Basketball, but turns out to be a very effective, very nicely done film by a young woman director who has is part of what I call the all-name team, and that's Gina Prince-Bythewood.
No.
So Gina Prince-Bythewood, who has a movie coming out later this year, her first feature film, I believe, with Love and Basketball, is my – those are my two video picks for the week.
Okay. And maybe also, as you talked about the fact that now we're coming into one of the big seasons for movie makers, the summer is one where we have our – sort of cotton candy roller coaster kind of movies. And then for those things that they think are their quality offerings, now we're coming to the point where, as you say, between Thanksgiving and Christmas Day, mm-hmm. lots and lots of movies and movies that I'm sure they think are going to be nominated for Academy Awards and
oh, yes.
so on. Anything that that you know that's going to be coming that you think might well be a good movie and something people would like to
see. Well, the one that I've been looking forward to ever since it played at Cannes is the latest film by Joel and Ethan Coen called Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Which has got to be both a comedy and a nice movie. So Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is one. And a movie that I'm really interested to see how it will perform, to get back to the business side of things, is Tom Hanks's latest movie, directed by Robert Zemeckis, reteaming the Forrest Gump people, called Castaway. And there's a lot of talk about Castaway coming, unfortunately, on the heels of Survivor. mm-hmm. And so how will this big-budget movie of Survivor sort of play out? Otherwise, one of the things that I think is interesting is that Hollywood is turning the Thanksgiving-Christmas season into a kind of mini-summer, because a lot of the things that are coming out are spectacle-oriented or almost juvenile, such as, you know, the live-action How the Grinch Stole Christmas or 102 Dalmatians. So it's interesting. So you never know where the small Oscar film will come from, but one hopes, at least for the Coen brothers, who gave us Fargo not too long ago, and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, at least has been a festival favorite.
mm-hmm. Well, we're just about at the point here where we're going to have to stop, and I'm sorry we have somebody here we can't take, but I know maybe a few months down the road, Dave will come back and we can do it again. So for the moment, we say thanks very much.
You're welcome.
For being here. David Desser, he's professor of cinema studies at the University of Illinois and occasionally stops by here on the program. We talk about movies.